This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. This is episode 166 of the podcast, 166, and today we're going to be talking about fly fishing rituals. But before we get to that, I have a couple of quick things I just want to mention. The first is something that I've been a part of for the last few months, and that is Waypoint. The Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast is part of Waypoint. What is Waypoint? Well, if you go to waypoint.tv, you will see a full scope of the offerings that Waypoint has to offer. There are hunting and fishing and fly fishing and hiking and homesteading resources, everything from podcasts to TV shows to educational resources and films. You can also get the app on the Apple Store or through Android. It's an amazing amount of stuff, and even as part of it, I've only waded through a few portions of everything that Waypoint has to offer, so I definitely recommend that to you. Secondly, and I'll keep this very brief, if you have a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and a review about the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I would greatly appreciate that. All right, 166. Rituals, fly fishing rituals. So fly fishing goes back centuries. And so there are so many rituals that have accumulated into our collective consciousness of when we go fly fishing. But what I'm really more concerned about and what I'm thinking about in this podcast today are those rituals that you might have, or you and your fishing buddies, or you and the folks that are at your trout camp that you engage in week after week, year after year. And I'll tell you why I've been thinking about this. I read an article yesterday from Meat Eater. So Meat Eater, if you're not familiar with that, you should be. Great resource. Steve Rinella, who you maybe know from the Meat Eater TV show, which is on Netflix these days, but great hunting and fishing content on there also. So this was an article that, again, came out yesterday from when this is being recorded, called The Post-Kill Traditions of North American Hunters. The Post-Kill Traditions of North American Hunters by a gent named Patrick Durkin. Great article, nice long article, great little header image of a guy holding a bleeding, what I presume to be deer heart, on the front of it. And I'll put a link to this article on the show notes of this podcast page on Casting Across. But it's a great look at how there aren't a lot of hunting rituals and traditions that we have in the United States, especially compared to places like Europe, where we really inherit a lot of our hunting methodology and heritage, where they have a rich history of hunting traditions, but we really haven't adopted many of those. And so it's interesting, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time just rehashing what's in this article, because again, I'd encourage you to go read it, but he mentions things that people that are traditional rituals that have been done that people are falling out of favor with today. I just want to read these because some of them are quite amusing. First, drinking alcohol with and without toasts or celebrations, which I can't imagine people don't like that. But blooding a successful hunter's face, ranging from streaks to full facials. And this is where, you know, you go to the kill, and as you're getting it, you put some of that blood on the hunter's face, especially if they are a first-time hunter, which, again, for somebody who doesn't appreciate where that comes from and how that's been done before, it certainly seems barbaric, and you might not be a fan of it if it's being done to you unwillingly. Eating the animal's raw or cooked heart, liver, or tenderloins. Now, that one, I really can't wrap my head around. Like, who would have a problem with eating a cooked piece of meat? You might say, oh, it's the heart. It's meat. It's all it is meat. It's a different part of meat. That's something that I've never understood. Like, someone who says, oh, you know, I could never eat a pig's foot. Well, do you eat pig shoulder? You know, do you eat ribs? How is that any different, better, or worse? You say, oh, well, it was on its foot. Well, it's cleaned. You know, where's ham? Ham is its rear end. So if you have a problem with you know, the location of meat before you eat it, then you've got a lot of problems. All right, anyway. Giving silent or audible thanks, tributes, or prayers, sometimes while kneeling. Yeah, hopefully you're not praying to an animal. Number five, this one's interesting. Hanging a buck's genitals from a branch near the gut pile. I don't know much about this. I haven't researched it. I'm a little afraid of Googling it and seeing what happens. But those are five examples of things that people are uncomfortable with when it comes to hunting traditions that have carried over from the old world. But I think there's a lot more potential for traditions and rituals in hunting than there is for fishing. And I think because you can be done, you know, if you get that animal in the middle of the day, then the shift and focus goes from looking for the animal to processing the animal. The shift in the whole camp, once people limit out, goes from grinding away and trying to fill your tags to enjoying the fact that you have filled your tags. Fishing, especially fly fishing, with the catch and release ethos that has really permeated fly fishing for the last few generations, you lose some of that. And I'm not advocating that we start killing fish just so that we can have fun things to do, some traditions and things like that. I just think that hunting lends itself more to some of these rituals. And also just the nature of the game that you're pursuing, the quarry being much larger, the quarry being something that can sustain not just you and your family for one meal, but for multiple meals, for maybe even a season. There's a greater kind of release once you've felled that elk or something like that than compared to when you catch four or five brook trout. Still, we have angling rituals and angling traditions. I've known people who've thrown the first fish back, even if they're fishing, well, not even if, because they're meat fishers, they still throw the first fish back of the fishing trip or of the season as a way of saying thank you. You might say, well, if you throw one back, but you keep a couple dozen over the course of a week, then what good are you doing? Again, the purpose of this conversation isn't about catch and release or conservation or things like that. It's about rituals. And I can appreciate that. That's somebody who says, I'm going to catch my limit of fish every day I'm out, but I'm going to throw this first one back this season as a way of being appreciative towards the resource and kind of showing that I enjoy the process of catching the fish as much as I enjoy the fish that I've caught and processing it, if that makes sense. Another ritual that I've never engaged in, but I have witnessed, is opening day. Opening day is quite the ritual for a lot of people. And where I lived in Pennsylvania, and I lived on a couple of incredibly popular and populated trout streams, and opening day was a real show. I mean, it was a circus. I can't even begin to explain how many people were shoulder to shoulder around some of these ponds. And then you get to a place where it was kind of cordoned off for children only, and it would look so sparsely populated. And it was funny because, you know, people, you could tell, and people would verbalize this, that, oh, if they could only fish where those kids were fishing. And it's not like the trout know or care. These trout just came out of the back of a hatchery truck like 2 days ago. They're going to be swimming at a frantic pace, dodging little Cleos and worms and people stripping, you know, multiple streamers in front of their faces. But all that to say, again, not to be critical, this was a ritual. People would wake up really early. They would go and find their spot. They would camp out. They would get everything set up. They would have their cooler and their little stove and all that sort of stuff. And you know what? That's not my style of fishing, but for some people, that is exactly what they think of when they think of fishing in those places. And that's their ritual. So of course you can kind of blow that out into something a little bit more romantic for most fly fishers' perspective, and that is, you know, opening up the cabin. You know, when does the spring trout season kick into gear? You go up that weekend, you get everything set, you get everything in place, you clean things out, you get rid of the mouse droppings, and all of those things that you do are then preparing you to actually get out and take your waders and your rod and your flies and go down to the stream and catch some fish and then come back and enjoy that experience you had on the water, either by yourself or with the people that have come with you in that cabin. And I think that's another thing. We've gotten away from the destination style angling, as you know, the trout camp or, you know, the family cabin, and we've turned it more into going to, you know, a lodge or something like that. And so when it's not yours, it's probably harder to develop those kind of rituals. But that doesn't mean that we can't have rituals. That doesn't mean that we don't have rituals. I give you another great example. This is probably, you know, the most mundane thing you can think of, but this is my fly fishing ritual. So when I first started fly fishing, I was living in Northern Virginia and I was probably 14 years old. And so I couldn't drive, and my friends that fly fish couldn't drive either. And so our parents would have to drive us. Getting up early is something that's gotten easier as I've gotten older. But as a teenager, getting up at 5 o'clock was not fun at all. Getting up at 6 o'clock wasn't even that fun. But what made it better was the stop at Sheetz, the stop at the gas station. And if you're not familiar with Sheetz, then you need to acquaint yourself with Sheetz. And even though it was just a breakfast sandwich and a cup of gas station coffee, it was more than that. And hopefully you can appreciate this. Hopefully you appreciate the value of a first cup of coffee in the morning, especially when it's early, when it's cold. But it was something to look forward to as you were waking up and groggily getting into the car. It was something to kind of wake you up as you were driving to the stream. And then that big, heavy sandwich was something that would sustain you for hours and hours on end, because there's a good chance you weren't going to necessarily eat lunch. And so even though it was something simple, it was something that happened every time, and it was something that had value, and it increased the enjoyment of the day fishing. And I would say that's something that has continued on to this day, where I rarely make myself a cup of coffee before I go fishing. I usually buy it, and I usually stop someplace where I can get something to eat. And that might sound, again, unimpressive compared to some of the more elaborate fly fishing rituals that exist out there at some of these legacy trout camps. But that's my fishing ritual, and it's something that I enjoy other people taking a part of. When I take somebody fishing and they say, oh, do you want me to, you know, make something for us? And nope. Here's how we're going to do it. This is how it's going to go. And that translates into other types of fishing also. So if I am staying somewhere, if I am in a cabin or I'm in a lodge, then I need to make sure that if the kitchen is not open, that there's a coffee pot in the my room so that I can have that. And it's an altered version of my normal fishing ritual. If I'm camping, then that is going to be an essential part of my morning. I've got my little camp stove and my pot with my coffee grounds in it that I'll pour through a filter into my camp mug. That's just a simple, basic thing that I do every other day of the week. I drink coffee every day, but in doing it in that particular way, in that moment, it, again, wakes me up and it gets me thinking about and prepares me for my time on the water. Now, some other fishing rituals. One that I've never engaged in, but I've heard plenty of people talk about and I've read about throughout a number of different books on fly fishing histories, is camps or families that have a traveling rod. I've been acquainted with one traveling rod through a fly fishing club that I was a part of for a few years. But the ritual of having one piece of gear that is shared by multiple members, not only is it a functional piece of gear, but it's a rod that you know that your uncle fished with last year, or maybe your grandpa fished with 15 years ago, or your mentor that taught you how to fly fish, he used it a couple years ago. It's a very simple thing, but it holds a lot of meaning. Something else that's essential and you have to do, but it can be a ritual, is a meal. I knew a buddy who the first night at camp was always kielbasa. It had to be kielbasa. I don't remember anything else that he made. I don't remember eating anything else, but I remember having kielbasa because that was the first thing that he would make when you went fishing. Kind of along those lines, I knew a guy who had a fishing camp, and they had a bottle of port wine that was, you know, 50 or 60 years old, because it was his great-grandfather's bottle of port wine. And, you know, you find out how much these guys drank while they were fishing, and you think, how in the world did this thing survive this long? Well, it's because they'd refill it. But it was the idea that you were drinking out of the same bottle that your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather drank out of. And so that was, for them, that was a simple thing that they could do to stay connected with those that had come before them. And really, at the end of the day, that's so much of what ritual is about. It's a connection. It's a connection with other people. It's a connection with your previous experiences. And that stuff is good. I know there's plenty of anglers who are super hardcore and all they want to do is catch fish. They're not worried about the fluff. They're not worried about the extra stuff. That's not why they're into it. But I would say that that is the minority. The majority of us appreciate the continuity between the things like that morning cup of coffee and getting out on the water. We appreciate that continuity between spending some time fishing, having varying levels of success, and then relaying those experiences to other people around the campfire. Those things actually improve the experience of being on the water. So you have a bad day, you don't catch fish, you fall in, you break a rod, but what can redeem that? What can redeem that is those other things that go along with it, those peripheral aspects to fly fishing that create this culture. And ritual is really a significant part of culture. So like I said, I don't feel like I have that remarkable of a catalog of fishing rituals that I engage in, but I'd be interested in hearing what you do. If you do have a family camp that you've had for generations, and there's things that y'all have adopted as being routine parts of your first week up, last week up, even just your normal fishing time. If you and your fishing buddies have been going to the same lodge for 10, 15, 20 years, and you've got some routines and rituals that you've fallen into, I think those stories are fantastic. So I'd love to explore this topic more. It was really kind of thought-provoking to think about just how there are hunting rituals and there are fishing rituals, but we might not have them in the same way that perhaps our ancestors did 100 or 200 years ago, or certainly before coming to the United States. So if you have anything, please send it my way, matthew@castingacross.com. Bare minimum, I'll get back to you and tell you how much I appreciate it, but we'll see. It might get included in a podcast or an article or something coming up in the near future. This week on castingacross.com, the first article is called Fishing the Gray. And I refer to New England's kind of winter and early spring as the gray season, which of course is followed by the mud season. But everything is just cold. Even when we don't have snow, and we usually do have snow, things just get very gray. And especially in these really short days where it starts getting dark around 3:30, 4 o'clock, everything's just gray. And so the last thing that would make sense would be to go out and fish in conditions like that. However, there's good fishing to be had, and fishing is better than no fishing. I don't even want to call it bad fishing, because bad fishing presupposes that fishing is all about results, and we know that's not true. It's so much about the possibility of results. It's about the potential of catching something, but even more than that, it's about seeing things. It's about being on the water. It's about experiencing so much of what nature has for us, and I think, truth be told, so much of what we miss out on when it comes to appreciating the flow from season to season comes from not experiencing what's there in the winter. I think that, and this is kind of going beyond the scope of what this article talked about, but if you fish in the winter, you can appreciate why the rivers that you fish in the spring are the way that they are. You understand tributaries better. You understand the flow conditions better. You understand what's going on in the stream banks better when there is no or little vegetation. And so there's a lot of benefits outside of maybe catching a fish by going fishing in the winter. Plus, you're getting outside and you're scratching that itch, and those things matter. The second article this week was called Actually Fishing in the Gray. So the first article got a lot of readership, and I'm always skeptical, like when something just pops for whatever reason. Like, why did that get so many people's eyes on it? So I realize there's a number of rivers called like the Gray River or the River Gray in the world, and so part of me wonders if like somebody or a lot of people thought I was giving some either narrative or how-to article on fishing their river or river they wanted to fish. So as kind of a way to right any wrong that I may have perpetrated, I wrote Actually Fishing the Gray. And so there's this great little picture of this stream in New England, and I write about how I would approach it, how I do approach it. When I come to a small, medium to small-sized stream where there's a lot of ice and there's snow, what is my approach? What is my tackle? What kind of cast am I going to make? What kind of flies am I going to use? And so I go through all those things on an article called Actually Fishing the Gray. Again, if you have been listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing podcast, I just want to remind you that the website, castingacross.com, has been around much longer. There's a lot more content. Oftentimes, what I talk about on the podcast is derivative from an article or articles that I've written on the podcast. So if you want a little bit more, or and you want it maybe in a more concise manner, then I would encourage you to go to castingacross.com. If you want to know if there's something that's there, if you have an idea for something, please let me know. Matthew@castingacross.com. Love to hear it. This week's recommendation on the podcast is what I mentioned earlier. It is that article from Meat Eater. So Meat Eater, I enjoy the Meat Eater show. Again, Steve Ranella's show on Netflix. It's just a good hunting show. There's times where he gets skunked. He hunts with rifle, with shotgun, with black powder, with muzzleloader, with archery. He hunts all over the country. There's fishing, but what's great about this show is that oftentimes it shows them processing and cooking game, usually in the field, which I'm always impressed by. Just I know how, like, for me, like, making like bacon and eggs when I'm camping is work. So to actually process an animal in the wild and then cook that and have it be as delicious looking as he does is always impressive for me. There's fishing content on there too, but the website, which is themeateater.com, has so much good content, as I mentioned earlier. But I'll put this link to this, the Post-Kill Traditions of North American Hunters article, on the show notes for this page of castingacross.com, so that you can read it and you can maybe get disgusted, or you maybe get intrigued, but bare minimum, you're going to be informed about parts of hunting and outdoors life that you may not have been acquainted with prior to. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing podcast. Please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast in iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.